A Novel Podcast is looking to produce more episodes, and we want you to join us. If you like reading novels and then talking about them, then you're a perfect candidate. We record remotely, so your location on Earth isn't a consideration, and no prior experience is necessary. Send us an email or a tweet, and let us know what books you'd like to discuss. anovelpodcast@gmail.com or @anovelpodcast. Look forward to hearing from you. You're listening to A Novel Podcast, in-depth discussions of literature from all genres and generations. I'm your host, Russell, and I'm joined by Miles, Sophia, and Dawn. Today, we're discussing the third and fourth books in the Chronicles of Brédain series, The Castle of Lear, released in 1966, and Tarin Wanderer, released in 1967. They continue the story of Tarin of Caer Daublin as he reunites with old companions, makes new friends and enemies, and pursues his quest to become more than he is. During today's episode, we're going to try our best to avoid major spoilers, but if you haven't read these books yet, I would advise you to go out and read them now before listening to us today. I would also suggest that if you're reading these books for the first time, you should skip the author's note, as they are plagued with spoilers. So I'd like to start with The Castle of Lear. I've asked Dawn if you could give us a quick plot synopsis here on The Castle of Lear.
Will do. I'll try to be brief. This is my favorite of the books, so it's tough for me to edit. But so we have about, I guess it's been about a year or so since the events of Book 2, The Black Cauldron, although that specific timeline's never given. And the raising of a princess in the man cave that is Caer Daublin has become a task Daublin no longer feels up to. So he's decreed that Illanwë is going to return to the kinfolk that were vaguely hinted at in Book 1. And Tarin, surprising himself, but probably nobody else in the reading audience, discovers that he cares enough about Illanwë to be deeply troubled with this. So Daublin allows him and Gurgi to accompany her on the journey, just to kind of make it easier. So they head out, and part of this journey being over water, they're met and transported by a ship whose commander in name, if not practice, is the feckless Prince Hrun, the son of King Rudlum and Queen Teleria, who are the monarchs of the Isle of Mona and apparent next of kin to Illanwë. The journey provides plenty of opportunity for Rune to demonstrate just what a well-meaning but incompetent simpleton he is, and for Tarin to demonstrate just how jealous he is that this guy with a title and a crown is as ridiculous as that, while he, despite all his accomplishments, is still just a pig eater. And of course, Illanwë is kind of bemused by all of this and keeps trying to assure him that that doesn't matter, but that only seems to make him more upset. So when they arrive, on Mona, Illanwë swept away to be settled in, and Tarin's kind of left alone to explore. He discovers that Flúidr is also a guest of the castle. And a little later, Gwydion shows up in the guise of a shoemaker, which is straight out of Welsh myth, by the way. He warns Tarin that not all is well at the castle and that Illanwë's life is in danger. It turns out that Akron, a little bit of a spoiler here, although I don't think anybody's super surprised, far from having perished in the fall of Spiral Castle, she is still very much alive and up to new tricks. So Gwydion charges Tarin to keep all this a secret and wants him to keep Illanwë safe, which Tarin proves as competent at that as he was with Henwin in Book 1. So within about 24 hours, Illanwë's been kidnapped by the traitorous chief steward of the castle, who sends her straight off to Akron. So that's how the main action is set up, the main conflict. Tarin winds up a member of the rescue party under the leadership of Prince Rune and is charged by the king himself to protect the life of the prince. And he makes this promise with a great deal of internal conflict because he also discovers that it's the intention of these monarchs to betroth Illanwë to their son. And so then a series of misadventures ensues. Rune is about as good a search party leader as he is at everything else, and they wind up separated and lost. And they come away from an abandoned hut with an apparently blank, empty book and the unwelcome attention of a supernaturally large wild cat. They wind up in a cavern and meet a giant named Glue, who I'll just tell you now is the one character in this whole series I would not complain about getting edited out of the potential film if that ever happens. eventually, they do make it out to have kind of a final showdown with Akron, who is holding Illanwë hostage and spellbound at her ancestral home on the ruin of Lear. And I won't give away the climax of all that, except to say that there's a very satisfying twist where it's Eilonwy's choices that drive the course of destiny in this particular book. And there's, you know, a big disastrous finale. It wraps up with she and Taryn kind of promising not to forget each other. And it's this very sweet kind of quasi potentially romantic moment that is unfortunately blacked out right when it gets good. And that's the end of the book. So hope I didn't give too much away. There's a lot of meat there, but there's the story in a nutshell.
No, I think that was excellent. Some of the themes that I noticed that continue on are, of course, this weaving the thread by thread. You're also seeing foreshadowing as well as, like you say, the fleshing out of story that has come before. You hear Glue mentioning a few characters that we're going to see later. What other themes did you guys pick up on? Continuations of those themes or ones you've seen before?
Mm-hmm. I always hit on the whole selflessness that's always brought to the fore, something that Taryn needs to learn from the beginning. But you see it particularly in when they find Eilonwy's bauble that she's dropped during the kidnapping. And you have the moment in Glue's cavern where, you know, none of them can get it to work because she's the only one that's ever been able to make it light up. And then kind of by accident, they discover that other people can get this thing to light up simply by being more concerned about others than they are for the moment about themselves. And that selflessness being something that has kept coming up and then will continue to come up in the future books. So that's a main point.
Each of the books seems to have a main theme, like a message to take away from it. Like in the Black Cauldron, it was everything has a price. In this one, the theme seems to be, for everyone, there comes a time when he or she must be more than what they are.
They are.
So Dalvin mentions that at the beginning, and then they repeat it a couple times throughout. And it helps them make some of the important decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's pretty significant character growth on all parts of the main characters. I mean, and the other theme that I find very interesting is the idea that you can see with the heart and not just with the external light. Mm-hmm. And you see this with the golden peledron and how maybe this is a spoiler as well too, but the way that Eilonwy breaks free from the spell is seeing her companions, not with her eyes, but with her heart. And that's what leads to her making the decision to, you know, give up what she has always loved and think only of others.
Yeah, and I definitely saw a bit of what I mentioned in the previous episode about the Star Trek factor, where Taryn's always trying to find a third way. You know, when there's a moment where they're caught and Fluta is about to sacrifice himself so that the others can get away, and Taryn protests. There's, you know, another moment where you had mentioned where they're stuck in the cavern of Glue, and Rune does the same thing. He says, "No, I can. I'll sacrifice myself," and Taryn tries to convince him, no, you can't. And inevitably, of course, they're finding these third ways, just a continuation on that same theme. And of course, not only of finding that third way, but also just of selflessness. Along that same path, I wanted to mention something that I found humorous. If you are a fan of Star Trek, you'll know that Worf continues to show up in various places. I found Fluta doing the same thing throughout this book, and then actually does it again in the next one to be rather humorous as well.
He's everywhere at once. Did anyone else see the I see a parallel between Taryn's moment with Adaon's brooch in the Black Cauldron and Eilonwy having to kind of renounce her, yes, heritage in this. There's that choice between all this power that's at my fingertips and this status that comes with that, but then having to sacrifice that for the greater good of the companions, and really for everyone, for the entire, because of the stakes that are, you know, at play. I just love that she has that same moment. And even though arguably she's kind of oftentimes the more emotionally mature of them, but he's already had this moment, and now she gets to have that as well in this story. I love that.
Yeah, that journey from selfishness to selflessness occurs over and over again in all the books. There is one thing I really would like to mention, and what really struck me with these books when I first read them, you know, when I was 7 years old, it was very rare, especially in those days, for there to be female characters, female protagonists that took action, and even female villains that were, you know, that were fully developed. Mm-hmm. And what I loved about this book, and this is probably one of my favorite books in my entire life, is that here you have this struggle between two female characters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can read it as just, oh, it's a damsel in distress story. Taran comes to rescue, you know, the woman he loves, but it's so much more than that. Mm-hmm. And I think that, this is one of Lloyd Alexander's real gifts as a writer, is that he was able to transcend many of the maybe more classically sexist views of the society and really have fully fledged characters that stood on their own, just like they do in real life. Mm-hmm. And that's partly why I loved it so much when I was a little girl, because at seven, there was very little, very, very few characters that represented women's power. And here you have the two contrasting characters of Alanwi and Ahrin representing the powers for good and powers for evil, but both of them are very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It was quite groundbreaking. You know, in the 60s, that I think it's more common now.
Yeah.
Very uncommon.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very rare then, though.
I remember when I read it thinking that Taran's, often his reaction to the idea of Ilanwi doing these warrior type things was kind of silly, but then realized, you know, in the 60s, maybe his attitude was more closely matched people of the time.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that's another way Ilanwi was a groundbreaking character, because she did all these things. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
you just didn't see that. It was extremely rare then.
So, Dawn, you had just mentioned earlier that this was your favorite book in the series. And, Sophia, you had mentioned to me that you've read this book, did you say 50 times or more?
Oh, yeah.
So would it be safe to say that it is your favorite in the series?
Definitely. This is it's my favorite not only in the series, it's my favorite of all of Lloyd Alexander's books, and it ranks probably among the top 10 books I've read in my life.
I'm intrigued by that. Miles, would you give me your interpretation? Where does this fit among the five books for you?
Oh, I don't know. I think I like the last four more than I like the first one, but mm-hmm. That's a really difficult choice.
It is.
It was one of my favorite ones to adapt, because I loved them exploring, you know, Mona and going into the history of Ilanwi's family and connecting the story, The True Enchanter, which explains how her parents met. Mm-hmm. I guess it's probably the lightest, the most lighthearted of all the books. And so maybe that, for that reason, I like it best in that capacity, but I really don't know if I can rank it along with the others.
Okay. I ask mostly because I've always considered this book, and don't get me wrong, I love this book, but I've always considered it to be the weak link among the entire series. Predominantly, I find that it's almost as if, we have to get rid of Ilanwi, so we'll send her home, and oh my goodness, now she's in trouble, and guess what? It's Ahrin again. That almost felt to me to be trite or contrived compared to the rest of the books, which always felt very genuine. I will say that it fits in very well. It's a very good anchor point between the first two and the last two. But did you feel that at all, or do you feel that when you look at the story, did you find it to be more genuine than I did?
I think where it fits in terms of Taran's progression, as in terms of his maturity, is like this is the very first time he finds himself having feelings for Ilanwi, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which, you know, takes him the whole book to kind of realize this and act on it, mm-hmm. And that drives his action, you know, in the next book a lot. But
yes.
But before he ever gets there, he has to accept this aspect of himself. So I don't, there might be something weak about this book, but I don't think that's it.
Okay.
I think with Ahrin, I've heard that argument, Russ. I've heard other people, you know, say that they felt this was the weak book. And I think ultimately it's sort of just a matter of opinion. But Ahrin is becomes a very important character again later. And this is getting into High King territory, so we can't give that too much away either. But if you really delve into her character, and she's an intriguing character because we don't know very much about her. We just see whatever we're given. And Sophia knows this, for those of us that write fan fiction, I mean, she's just rife with possibility, because you're not always sure of her motivations. And this particular book and what happens to her, both the action that she drives and then, the consequences of that are both very important in the larger context of Prydain. I mean, at this point, she almost gets her throne back. I mean, that's why she wants Illanwë. It's not because she didn't want to put Illanwë on the throne. She wants to get it back herself. And, you know, her failure of that and her brokenness by the end of this novel, is a direct, you know, directly affects then what happens, not so much book four, but book five. And that's all. And as we know, what happens there is crucial. So.
Yeah, that's true.
Lord Alexander, he was so good at just doing things that seemed seemed strange at the time. Like, okay, and even glue. Why does he put glue in here? Who is this guy? And yet would bring these characters back and bring them back later for very important, you know, reasons. So there was never really a moment where you were thinking, where I thought, oh, you know, this was predictable. Even though maybe you could argue, I guess, that it is, but. He always had a greater plan in mind, I think.
You know, you bring up a really good point, because that may have been my feelings the first time I read the book, but I've read it three or four times since, and each time I do seem to pick up on something new or realize how the last two books hinge on what happens in this book. It really is quite a fulcrum for the whole story. I've appreciated it more each time.
Mm. Yes, and what I think is very important about Alexander's skill is the way he gives all the characters a full character arc. It's extremely rare. So there are two villains in this story, Achran and Glue. And in the entire five book series, you will see them. They both have a character arc and character development, which is very, very rare. Mm-hmm. This I think represents Alexander's skill as a storyteller. Is it's not just that he's telling this great tale, but that all of his characters are incredibly vivid and complex, and they all work, you know, their stories are all woven together like a tapestry. And
there it is again.
Yeah, right. And as somebody who's been struck, you know, I wrote this novel and it is really difficult to get all your character's story arcs to come together at the end. Endings are hugely difficult to write well, because the choice is narrow as time goes on. Mm-hmm. And to see that someone has been able to build this tapestry and make all the character arcs come together at the very end and have it all be so satisfying is really means that he's a consummate storyteller. And this is what makes him, I think, one of the greatest fantasy authors we've ever had, writing in English.
Mm-hmm. So another theme that I picked up on is, of course, we're growing with Taran as we go through these books. And it seems like so far in each book, he's come to a point where he has to decide, do I take action or do I go and run for help? Do I go running after the Horn King, or do I go running back home? Do I seek the Marshes of Morvo on my own, or do I go back home? Or do I chase after Mag and Illanwë, or do I go back home? So this continuing theme, how does that fit in with some of the other things of growth? And is he making the right choices? Is he going to continue making these choices? Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think one of the issues is that there may not be any right choices. I think a key theme is that choices are difficult, and there's pain and risk on all of them, and yet you have to make them. I mean, this is how Taran is developing his leadership and becoming grown, by making the decisions the best he can on perhaps incomplete information, but then continuing on. And I think that's something that all of us have to learn as we grow.
Yes, and I also noticed that just as you say, Taran is learning about leadership. One of the things he's absolutely thrust into learning now is how to deal with people that he just doesn't like, and how to get past that initial, oh, I don't care for you very much, and learn what's in a person's actual heart. You know, we deal with that all the time, and of course he's dealing with that now for the very first time. It's fun to watch it from a certain extent, and then from another viewpoint, it's incredibly painful to watch.
His nobility just has a chance to come out all the time. It's the irony of the series is that he constantly thinks of himself as so, you know, I wish I were nobly born. When in his character, he's always taking the noble choice. He's always making the difficult choice, the right choice. I mean, and I know, Sophia, I agree with you that sometimes there is no right choice, but he's always making, he's never shying away from the difficult path just because it's difficult. He's always trying to do the right thing, which gives him this inherent nobility. And how, I mean, and in this particular book, the level of self-sacrifice to have to submit to the leadership of this guy who really just at the beginning is a complete fool. Not only that, but to realize that he's your rival for the girl that you're in love with. I mean, my God, it's like, it's really, really.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, I just love, you guys know, I love Taran so much. And this is one of the reasons is because no matter how difficult it is, he always does the right thing. Always.
Yes. Yes. And that's one thing that's wonderful about him is even in the very first book where he really is kind of a stupid fool, but he still, his heart is always in the right place. And to see his heart grow and develop and to see him grow into the kind of person you know he has inside him is really thrilling.
Mm-hmm. Well, if anybody else has any other thoughts about The Castle of Lyra, I'd love to entertain them now.
Oh, I could talk about this book for...
You and I just need to have a private combo on this one.
All right, well, that we'll go ahead and move on to the fourth book, Taran Wanderer. I've elected myself to give a brief plot synopsis, so here goes. Sick at heart, being without Ilanwe, he leaves Caer Dalbyn on a quest to find his parents. He starts by going to visit the witches, Ordu, Orwen, and Orgok in the marshes of Morva, who we saw in the second book, The Black Cauldron. They aren't able to give him the answer that he needs, but they suggest that he visits the Mirror of Lunet. He begins his quest, and along his way gets sidetracked a number of ways. He meets with King Smoit, helps him solve several issues for some of the lords under his rule. He joins up with Flute of Flam again, and together they leave Smoit's realm to help the old farmer Craddock, who they learn that he has certain ties to. He faces a new threat to the race of men and to fair folk, reuniting with his dwarven friend Dolly. And finally, he journeys through numerous villages and tries his hand at a variety of trades, learning to earn his keep, helping those he encounters. Throughout the book, he learns that he has something to offer, that he has merit and worth, and that he, in the end, finds what he was questing for, but not in the way that he was expecting to find it. The book ends with him returning to Caer Dalbyn and nicely sets up the fifth and final book. So again, we're of course seeing the same theme that I've mentioned every time, which is the weaving of threads. And the first thing I noticed is when he does visit the witches in the marshes of Borva, he notices that the loom, which had some kind of a tapestry of some kind of not quite finished on it, he sees that it's been worked on. And of course, that just continues that same theme. What I noticed there is it's almost the author just kind of screaming at us, hey, maybe you should be paying attention to this. So I'm curious if that tapestry that you see there, if you see any other more direct parallels to either that or other themes in a kind of a corporeal way in that regard.
Well, the theme of the Mirror of Lunet, if that's how it's pronounced, is pretty. That's a very clear, the symbol of the magical mirror where you can see the truth, you can see what's inside your own soul. Mm-hmm. And then the fact that it's destroyed by careless greed and selfishness again.
Mm-hmm. Well, one point through the book, the question was asked, what is the magic of the mirror? Mm-hmm. And I was curious, is there any magic at all? And what would be How often would a person in Taran's shoes in that situation actually be looking in a mirror? Would the places he have gone had mirrors for him to look at? Is it possible that he looked in one at Caer Dalbyn and then here he goes on this quest and doesn't actually see a mirror until after going through all of these adventures and being in trials and tribulations?
Well, we don't know, but we do know that Anlaw, Clayshaper, said that he looked into the mirror, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's something probably kind of like a Daon's brooch. Here, I'm coming back to the brooch again. But it's, if you already know who you are, then it's just going to kind of maybe enhance your who you are already. If you don't know, you're just going to be confused by it. I think if for him, the magic's not in the mirror, which by all accounts is just an ordinary pool of water. It's the magic is in the journey of getting there. And this is a theme that really we're going to hit hard in The High King, just because of how the series ends. So I don't want to give too much away here, but the fact that almost the entire last half of the book has Taran learning all these handcrafts and skills, these trades, is really key. If you ever has everybody here, I think was it Todd that hadn't read the stories in The Foundling? Has everyone read
that? I have not.
You have not, Russ. Okay. There's one story there, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's one where it's a prequel where Aron tricks some of the greatest tradesmen in Prydain out of their tools. So he
the smith, the weaver, and the harper.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So he goes to the smith, who's this master, blacksmith who can make anything and has this wonderful old hammer that he's had for his entire trade. And Aron disguises himself and shows up and has like this hammer that, this is my magic hammer and it'll do all the work by itself and I can just relax. And the guy's like, oh, that's great, And so, I'll trade it to you. And so he trades him the hammer. And then after he leaves, the smith is left with this tool that's suddenly worthless. It's not magic. It was a trick. And in so doing, he steals the greatest, skills from Prydain. And that's what he's keeping in his storehouse, because now that he has this guy's hammer, which has literally kind of a symbol of all his skill and knowledge and wisdom. And he's taken that. So the fact that Taran, first of all, and I don't even know if Lloyd had thought of doing this story before he, or if that was even in his head, but that he goes back and does these trades and learns smithing and weaving, doesn't learn harping, obviously, but there's this sense of the self-made man and the simplicity of hard work and the value of hard work, as opposed to how magic is used in Alexander's world, very different than how it was used, say, in Narnia or Harry Potter. In Alexander's world, Prydain, magic is the symbol for immaturity, I think, and for just for incompleteness. If you notice, most of the characters who are able to use magic, the good ones never do. I mean, we never see Dalbyn use magic until the very last book. Gwydion uses it at great, great need. Alanwy hardly ever uses it. The ones that do use it all the time are the bad guys, and it's always some shortcut. Oh, I need this magical cauldron because it gives me so much power. I need this magical object that will give me all the power. It's always this race to it's kind of that Star Wars, like the dark side. Is the dark side stronger? No, but it's easier. They're always seeking magic because it's easier, because it's a quicker rush to power. Whereas what Lloyd is hitting us over the head with is that, with the Daon's brooch, Taran could have just kept that and been this incredible guy, but it wouldn't have been him. It would have been some fake, phony version of him that was really powerful, but nothing that he had earned himself. And so in Wanderer, he's forced to earn his own, what does Ordu say? Is that, the chicken ever scratched for his own worms? That's what he has to do. He has to learn the value of hard work, of discipline, of, I'm talking, but somebody else jump in.
I think the mirror gives him a chance. Like he spends his whole book trying to figure out who he is, but in the back of his head, he all has all these fears and preconceptions. And the idea that this mirror can tell him the truth gives him a chance to lay those all aside and just accept whatever it tells him. And since it's just his reflection, he finally sees that without all that other stuff fogging it up and obscuring his vision. He finally is able to see himself clearly.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think this is a version of the classic quest tale where you seek, the idea is that people go to seek some magic, that some power that is outside themselves, and then they discover that it was within them all along. Mm-hmm. And this is a very classic story that's been told over and over again, spiritually as well through human history, that you need to find the answers lie deep within you. And this is, I think, the lesson that he's learning in this book in particular.
Yeah, and you say the answer lies within you. I think that's exactly what he learns as he travels through the free comets. You know, of course, he meets with Lonia, who basically teaches him, hey, if you don't play, you don't win. You have to cast your nets. He meets with Hevet the Smith, if you can stand the pounding and stand the forge, that you'll be tested and you'll come out stronger. From Dwivak, he learns that you must decide your patterns and weave it, you know, one thread at a time. And if you don't like what it's become, it's going to take a lot of work to unravel it, but that work will probably be worth it. And then, of course, from Manlaw, he learns you must shape it. So from each of these people, he's learning a different skill that's helping him draw something from something else, making something from nothing. And is that what he's really doing with himself as well? He's saying, well, okay, so from within this bucket of mud can make beautiful pottery. From this room filled with cockle burrs and thread, I can weave this cloak for myself and carry it with me. And of course, we see that with Hevet the Smith as he makes a sword that becomes, and I won't say what happens with the sword because it's awesome, but what does happen with the sword becomes very poignant.
Yeah, but there's no shortcuts. There's no shortcuts.
Mm-hmm.
Notice all of these guys, whenever he picks up the new trade, it's never like, oh, here's a bar of iron, let's make a sword. No, he has to go back and smelt the metal. You know, he has to go dig the clay. He has to actually get the wool and dye it and spin it and all that other. Mm-hmm. And it's just that parallel to where, no, he can't just go. Nobody's going to show him, here's the mirror, let's take a look in. That would be a shortcut. That would be using the lazy way, the magic way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's... Yes. That would be totally, you know, that. So the story that he's telling us is it wouldn't have done Tyrion any good to go straight to the mirror and look in it. He had to make this journey first so that, ironically, by the time he actually gets to the mirror, he doesn't really need it anymore.
Mm. And you can see that with the witches in the Marshes of Morva. He says, I pledge whatever treasure you want. Just give me the answer. And they decline.
Yeah.
They say, no, that's a bad idea.
Yeah, the other lesson that I thought was that really struck me as a child when I read this is the way that Tauron tries these three skills, trying to discover if they are what he's meant to be. Mm-hmm. And what I thought was wonderful is that he was good at two of them, but he didn't feel that was what he wanted to do. So he had some intrinsic ability, but it wasn't what called to him. Mm-hmm. And then the third one, he said, this is what I really want to do. This is where I feel my heart is in this type of artwork. And yet that was the one that he didn't have talent for.
Mm-hmm. And I read that paralleled something that happened to Lloyd Alexander himself, that he loved music. And one day he decided to try and learn the violin, but sadly discovered that he had started too late for really to go that far with it. And his teacher told him basically what Anlos says. It's a good thing you're figuring this out now rather than later after wasting so much time.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, no, I think that, I mean, that's, it's a wonderful lesson to learn that served me well throughout my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's heartbreaking. It's that bit of, I think I said this last time too, that it's that respectfulness of a child audience. That it's not just made cut and dry and happy ending for them. There's, you know, as a kid, you wonder, well, why can't he do that? You know, it seems very sad. And as adults, we read that and go, yeah, it is that way sometimes. That's just life. And, you know, and he didn't talk down to his audience at all.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Now, to take a quick step back, in the cast of Lyra, of course, I mentioned that Glue dropped a few names. So we're seeing that fulcrum effect again, where he mentions Gorion and Ghast, which are two of the lords in King Smoit's realm. And of course, Tarn comes across these guys and comes up with some rather interesting solutions to some of the problems that they have. And of course, they're classics. You had mentioned, Dawn, you'd mentioned Tarn making the noble choice. I found that moment is kind of a turning point in Tarn's life, because it's a moment where he's given a chance to be put in charge and makes the best of it and really succeeds.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love how shrewd he is in that particular interaction. You don't see that a lot from him because he's usually so very black and white, you know, he's very, very morally upright. And in that particular case, he has to suddenly become a little bit sneaky and a little bit like cleverer than the guys that he's, you know, that he's getting around. And it was kind of a very unique and delightful twist, because part of it is that in most of their when Elanwy's around, she's kind of the clever one. And I don't say, you know, it's she's the one that's always kind of very quick-witted and being the voice of practicality and maybe just not giving him a chance to get a word in. So now without her there, he has to come up with those things and does very well. And you think, oh, he gives this new respect for Tarn intellectually that he's able to, you know, work out those solutions, kind of almost a Solomon-like, wisdom in how he deals with these guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's, of course, there with King Smoit the whole time, and all Smoit wants to do is throw him in the dungeons.
Yeah.
And, of course, that is what reminded me of what you'd said earlier, which was using magic as kind of a lazy way out. You could almost see King Smoit using the dungeons as a lazy way out. And then, of course, Tarn looking for the third way, looking for that solution, finding it in this situation. And, of course, Smoit very impressed with that. One thing I did notice, of course, is that Tarn is now dealing with some rather serious enemies and dealing with them on his own. He doesn't have Gwydion there to back him up anymore, or at least, you know, not in this book. So Dorath being the first of those two enemies, I was wondering what everyone here thought of Dorath.
I can't say what I think of him in
front of
the audience. No, he's probably one of the more serious villains, obviously besides the big ones, the Akron and the Horned King and things like that. Dorath is more kind of a human villain. There's nothing supernatural about him. He's just
True.
You know, he's just a jerk.
And he's the most realistic villain in the book. And it's,
he's clever, vicious, ruthless, strong.
And just motivated by his own, you know, he's not one of these that I want to take over the world. He's just I can't think of a good word that's not bad. he's so self-serving and ruthless in just his own, you know, wickedness. For that reason, very real. We all know people like that.
Yeah, we've all met people like this.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a character flaw, a tragic flaw in that. Brings about the downfall that he sees in the book. But, of course, we've not seen the last of him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you brought up Morda.
Yes.
Which is, in many ways, one of my very favorite aspects of the entire series. The whole character is introduced in an interesting way and, of course, has influences far-reaching forward as well as has been influenced by classic old stories. So basically the idea is while they're on their journey, Tarn runs into Leon picks up a frog that happens to be able to speak. They come to find out that it's Dolly, and he's on a quest to figure out what is going on in this little den on the other side of these huge walls of thorns where Fuerfolk have been going missing. And without saying too much, I'll just mention that there is quite a bit of backstory behind this character. When I first read this book, though, of course, this creature is seen on the cover. I expected the story would be the climax, would be his battle with Morda, and of course it's not. But it is far from a throwaway story. Well, let me ask you guys this. What was your take on Morda?
One thing, of course, is that one device used with him is involving his finger. It touches on a theme that's in so many other fantasy stories, like the Fire Bird, the Heartless Giant, Voldemort, the idea of a villain who can't be killed because his life essence isn't in his body. It's elsewhere.
Right.
I had read that it had come from a Slavic folk tale of Koshay the Deathless, a sorcerer who hid his soul. And this I found humorous. He apparently hid his soul inside a needle, which was in an egg, in a duck, which was in a rabbit, in a treasure chest, in a tree, on an island.
There are lots of stories where, the villain hides something in an egg, like the Firebird and the Heartless Giant. They're both in eggs. So, yeah. Maybe it stems from the same place.
I would assume as much. Yeah. That, of course, reminds me of one of the Riddles in the Dark from The Hobbit.
Oh, yeah.
A box without, what is it? A box without...
It's just your lid.
Your lid, the gold treasure.
Exactly right.
So, right, I later on learned that this was a common theme, but of course, reading it at age 7, I guess I was 8 when I read this one. The whole concept of somebody taking their life out of their body and putting it someplace else just struck me as incredibly stupid. where else to better, save your, protect your life, but where you are conscious and aware of it, where you can, fight people who might try to take it. And the idea of hiding it somewhere else, just, it didn't make any sense to me as an 8-year-old, but... But anyway, it is this. I learned later on it was this common theme that has been used over and over again, and this ties again back, I think, with this theme of selfishness that Alexander has. The idea that somehow, protecting your own life at the cost of all others is what some people want, and yet that's not a good idea at all. And that ties back to this one story in The Foundling too, if the stone. Mm-hmm. You remember that with a farmer that meets Dolly and gets a stone that will keep its owner from aging, and then in the end learns that it has a problem.
Yeah.
And that he realizes that staying young forever isn't what it's cut out to be, and there's something to be said for being a part of the seasons, and he's happy with his life as it changes.
To go back and read that one now. I've forgotten about that one.
Yeah.
I just like how the Morta scene gives you a little bit. I love those aha moments because now you know where the spell book came from and what happened to Elanwë's mother. Mm-hmm. And it's just those little bits of backstory that lend, I think, to the feeling of authenticity, of realism almost. That's not really the right word, but that there was so much more to the story in his head that he didn't even put down just because of those details that are all woven together in the background and how they're get little hints here and there.
Right. This is something that the great writers of fantasy do. And I heard it called intratextuality, where they refer back to the backwards and forwards to their own stories. And again, it makes it like an embroidery, right?
Oh, I like that.
And certainly J.K. Rowling did this, referring forwards and backwards, and the role that Ron played as a almost a seer as well, where he would foretell the future in jokes.
Well, again, to the character of Morta, who I loved reading that part. I was tense and filled with action, but it was something that would really built up to. Morta, to me, solidified the Harry Potter series, which I had read to its completion before I even picked up anything from Prydain. It just felt so similar in so many ways. You've got Hermione Granger being very, very clever all the time, just like Elanwë will be. You have the story of Etharneth being just like the Dementor prison. And then Morta, you meet this guy who is snake-like, lidless eyes, has a disdain for humanity, this vicious backstory, hiding his soul inside a seemingly innocuous item so that he can achieve immortality, which is everything that he always wanted. I see that the comparison there hinges, but then looking back at, of course, Koshay the Deathless, we see it goes back so much further. I not only enjoyed the Voldemort story, but I thoroughly enjoyed Morta and love what direction that this series is going in.
It's funny because this particular book was, for me reading it as when I was young, this book was not as interesting to me because Elanwy's not in it.
Yes, yes.
So yeah, it's really, it's hard. I think for the female audience, it's a little bit harder to get into.
I wonder if he had written this book, like this is the last book that he wrote at the suggestion of his publisher. I wonder if he had written it in order, maybe she would have been in it.
Honestly, and Miles, did you, and I know I've spoken about this in other venues, but in his archives out in the library in Pennsylvania, you can see some of his notes. And one of them is a timeline that shows where each book, you know, appears on the timeline. And there is actually an entry for a novel that would have been a companion novel to this one called, probably a tentative title, but Elanwy's Education. And it would have been about her time on Mona, concurrent to this. And you know, ultimately, obviously, he didn't write that book. And I find it very bittersweet. I love the idea that that was even in his mind to do, because to me, it shows that she was as important to him, you know, as Taran was, and her story was as important. But also, I understand why they left it out, because the whole, taken on in its entirety, the cycle is Taran's story. So to, you know, take too much of a break from that would have been kind of inconsistent. But it really just thrilled me the first time. I was thrilled, and then I cried because I thought, I will never know that story. But it was. I do wonder if he had it to do over, if he would have tried to kind of pull her in a little more.
Yeah.
So do you feel like if he had written that story, you know, Taran's obviously distraught at learning how he feels about Elanwy, especially now that he's got to kind of learn it the hard way. She's going away. She's betrothed. She's gone. What do you think Elanwy's feelings would have been? What would have her motivation have been through that book?
Good question. I actually was writing a fan fiction on that very topic for a long time, and I haven't gone back to that in years. But we know from her description in The High King that she was very disdainful of castle life and, you know, having to curtsy all the time and have her hair washed. But at the same time, you know, there had to have been more than that going on, because, you know, even if she doesn't ultimately end up marrying Hrun, they're still grooming her to be, you know, royalty, and being a queen in those days was not an easy job. You weren't just sitting around, you know, embroidering things while your husband ran everything. You were expected to be able to take care of everything while he was off to war or whatever else he might be doing. So I think it would have been interesting to explore kind of what she was doing, what she was learning there, and how one of the things that I learned, and this is getting into High King territory, but when she comes back in, her personality hasn't changed, but it's grown. And whereas before she would have, you know, had tantrums about things, now she has this kind of very artful way of kind of manipulating and making the guys think it's their idea, but really she's like getting around and flattering. And it's, from a feminist perspective, it's almost a little bit like, I don't know if I like what they did with her hair, but it's also very practical. You know, she manages to still be the voice of reason, but no longer by insulting everyone, but by kind of flattering them. And you know, you're Fluter, you're so clever. How did you ever think of that? And he's, oh. And it's just, and you think, okay, if nothing else, she's learned how to be diplomatic on Mona. And probably Talaria taught her that, because I don't think Hrun did.
When you asked about what Elanwy's character would be in the Tarn Wanderer sort of story, it made me think of, like, when I was coming up with ideas to turn Taran Wanderer into a screenplay, I thought, well, I would probably want Elanwy in there, and I spent years trying to figure out not only how to get her in there, but also, you know, the story doesn't lend itself to a movie type structure anyway, so it took me years to come up with something that felt like it worked. And what I came up with, she does go on Taran with on this adventure, but it's more centered around Morta. I made Morta the main villain in it, and she's brought in because of that, because of his connection to her family. And so she and Taran, they go through an arc. Their relationship goes through an arc too. When he discovers his father, he you know, Taran thinks he's not worth it of her, and so they end up having a confrontation where he doesn't really express well enough what's going on for him, and she thinks, oh well, he doesn't love me anymore, and so their relationship goes through a bit of a testing there, but they do work it out by the end.
That's an interesting adaptation, Miles.
Thank you.
I would love to see that, but I do think it's very different from what Alexander intended in this. And I think your story would be wonderful too. I hope you do adapt it, and I'd love to see it as a screenplay.
Thank you.
But
I tried to keep thinking, like, how can I make this the same story only with these different elements? And it was important to me to get as much of Lloyd Alexander's intention through as I could.
Yeah, I think that it's, I mean, I didn't like this story as much too because it didn't have Ilonwy in it. But looking back on it now, I think it was necessary. And I think the reason Alexander had the idea for Ilonwy's companion story is because, you know, I think at this stage, this book shows really Taran becoming a man. Mm-hmm. This is the step that he takes so that he can be, you know, play the role he does in the fifth book. And you would need to have that because there's a big jump in his personality in the Castle of Lear and what it is at the start of the High King. And there also is a corresponding jump in Ilonwy's personality as well. And so maybe he would have, you know, Alexander would have written, maybe that's why he saw the parallel arcs coming together again in the fifth book, right? So there was a Taran story and then Ilonwy's story and then they meet again. My thought is the reason why he never wrote Ilonwy's story is because there just wouldn't be as much drama in it. Yeah. As Dawn said, really what, for her, it was kind of a practical decision, which was sort of sad, reading it as a feminist as well. You can see that she has grown, but there's also a sadness to it. And so it doesn't have the same kind of upbeat, optimistic view that all the other books have, that you overcome adversity to become stronger. It's more, this is how things work out in the world. And right. And it wouldn't have the same appeal to me.
Yeah, I agree. I think where I had originally intended to take that comment was, although I didn't appreciate the book for that reason as much as a child or as a teen reading it, the more I read that particular book and the series as a whole, the more I realized how crucial Taran Wanderer is to to the book, to the series. It's arguable, and I know for some people it is their favorite because it's so, I think there's, especially for adults reading it, we can all see ourselves in that journey that he takes. And that's the only thing that really, really makes the events in The High King believable of him at this point, because he's just not that same person that he is at the end of Castle of Lear. And as much as we love him then, he has so much growing up to do still. And I do think that he couldn't have done that with Ilonwy around to be distracting. He had to go out his own and find his own motivation. You know, he can tell himself, well, this is because I want to impress her with my parentage. But really, it's he himself that he's trying to prove himself to, because he's always been, low self-esteem or low confidence or whatever you want to call that, just full of these questions. And he's finding himself in this, and that has to happen in order for him to take on the role that he does in the last book.
Yeah. One of the big themes I picked up on was learning how he can control his inner struggles. In fact, at one point, Flute even says, listen, I know you wanted to do that other thing, but you should really count the deed, not the thought.
Mm. Yeah.
The one, what I mentioned earlier, the one part of Castle of Lear that I thought made it slightly weaker was that it isn't Taran who makes the big decision that sort of decides the outcome of the story. It's Gwydion who makes the final action. Mm-hmm. And what's different about Taran Wanderer is Taran is really definitely doing everything to drive the story forward.
Well, yeah. I think it's Ilonwy that makes the decision in the Castle of Lear. And that's what I liked about it.
Yeah. I agree with that. I can see, Miles, I see what you're saying. Gwydion opens the door for her to do that.
Yes.
But she's the one that
you're right.
That pins on.
Isn't it even said very specifically at the end of the book that it was Gwydion who said, I trusted that she would make that decision, right? Something along those lines?
Right.
Right.
But I know what you're saying. Taran, it's the Wanderer is the first book where it's really just Taran and everything is revolving around his decisions.
So. All right. Well, with that, I'm going to head and close up tonight. But before we do close, if anybody has any final last comment, I'd like to open the floor if you have any one last thought. And in addition to that, Sophia, I had said that you and I were talking about your book that you published recently. So if you'd like to tell us a little bit about that, please go ahead. So, Sophia, I'd like to start with you.
Oh, wow. Great. Okay. So thank you very much, Russ. I recently published my first novel. It's a new adult contemporary romance called Play at Soul's Edge. It just came out in October, and I'm very excited about it. It's a story about, as maybe came out in this, during this podcast, I'm very interested in conflicted and flawed characters and, you know, moral growth and morality plays. And so in this story, there's a character that really would be called a villain that goes through character growth. There are two, it's a romance. So there's a male and a female lead, and they both explore the ideas of good and evil. And they talk about what does good mean? What does evil mean? And they both learn that their definitions of what those are shaped by society and that they perhaps need to learn the true meanings of them through their actions.
Well, I'll look for that for certain. Any final comments, Miles, Dawn?
No, thank you. I was just going to mention to Sophia, I would love to look up your book. And if you'd like to send me your contact info, if you're interested in reading my screenplay adaptations, I can send those to you.
That would be terrific. Sure.
They're fun.
Okay.
I love doing this, you guys. I can't wait for the next one.
Me too.
Yes, thank you everybody for joining us. Have a good evening.